Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Deputy Editor Lee Boyce today is Assistant Editor Helen Crane. And coming up, inflation is up again. But which items have been hitting our pockets the hardest? And what was life like back when the cost of living was last this high, way back in 1982? It looks likely that the base rate could rise to 2.25% next month. But what about if it hits 3, 5 or even 7%? What would happen to mortgage rates then? Also today, we uncover Britain's lost billions and Lee looks at savings for his daughter's future. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at etoro.com/academy/podcasts.
But first, inflation is up again. CPI hit 10.1% last month, food sadly being one of the big drivers. The last time we saw it this high was back in February 1982, when CPI was 10.4%. So we thought we'd take a look at what life and the economy was really like back then. Bear in mind that none of us here were either alive or, in my case, old enough to remember. But first, Lee, a quick one, if you would, welcome to you both, about the latest inflation figures, Lee. Not a huge surprise has come up, but a bit more than we were expecting. What's the cause?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things, isn't it? We're expecting inflation to keep rising and to keep rising in the next few months. And by how high and how fast, there's been all sorts of measures and guesses and predictions. Now, when we actually get these cold, hard facts and stats and see it in actual written down and it's gone over double digits, I think that's quite a significant sort of milestone when you see it go beyond 10% CPI measure of inflation, which is the measure of inflation, though flawed, what a lot of people will take as the actual measure of inflation that a lot of people use. Okay, so it's going up very fast. People's own personal inflation rate, hard to work out. There's a lot of people that will be saying 10.1%. My inflation rate is far higher than that. And the big drivers, really, food and energy. They are really the two things that have been highlighted. And it's no surprise. It's not that I'm telling you something new here. It's just that we haven't even had the rise that's coming in the energy bills, the real big rise that is probably going to be the biggest rise altogether throughout the whole of this sort of cost of living crisis and this energy crisis, which is going to come by in October, which is going to have a real ramification on this CPI measure of inflation. As you say, it was a little bit larger than expected, but at the moment, it could have really landed anywhere. And I think people would have been like, yeah, could it kind of make sense? Yeah. Because in these stats, Georgie, and when you break it down, energy, as I was just saying, has obviously gone up a lot. So in the last 12 months, this is according to the official data, gas is 95.7%, electricity 54%. So that's obviously two massive figures and pretty much the main driver currently of inflation.
I was writing an article about this before the podcast, actually, Lee, and I'd written, you know, what the energy price cap is predicted to go up by this January, because of the new changes coming in, which mean that the price cap will change every 3 months rather than 6 months. £4,300. And I looked at, I thought, what was it in January 2001? And it's the price cap was 1,042. 1,042 to 4,003. And that's just a prediction. Some people saying it could go even higher.
Yeah, exactly. So there is a way more inflation pain ready to be felt, because as we were saying in the podcast last week as well, these energy costs are getting passed on in all kinds of different industries. And it's, again, a main driver of why other things are becoming more expensive for it. So a real example of that is food. They're actually broken down in these stats of what is going up. Now, absolutely everything has gone up.
This is one of the geekiest articles I think I've seen on your website. I mean, it is literally just a list. We don't have to go into the list. That doesn't make entertaining audio. But want to know the breakdown of some of the items, you know, pizza and quiche is in there. That's up 9.9%. I'm a big fan of quiche, I have to say. All sorts of things in here, Lee. Sticks out for you?
Well, the real staples that are in here, low-fat milk, I mean, 34%, butter, 27.1%, pasta and couscous, 24.4%. Oh, massive rises for households to suck up. Yeah. You know, these are household staples that people buy in their shop week in, week out, and money is just not stretching further. Already having to deal with energy bills that are rising. Other costs are not helping either. One of the other things that was in here as well, which we've been warned about, I remember we did the podcast a couple of weeks ago with Ryanair talking about the age of cheap travel. Airfares are up 37.1%, which is chunky compared to all of the other transport costs. And the cost of having fun is going up. Cinema, theatre, concerts up 14%. I mean, that is pretty incredible. Actually, just while we're on the subjects of concerts, I went to a gig this week.
Nice.
Went to see Coldplay at Wembley on Tuesday.
I was about to say, the problem with talking about the cost of living is we can tend to get caught down these dark rabbit holes of sort of depressive chat. And I thought, oh, no, Lee's going to talk about going to a great concert. And you talked about Coldplay.
Well, listen.
You've just brought the conversation right down there, Lee.
I got invited, so I went. You know,
don't get me wrong, they're very good, just a bit depressing.
Well, that's what I thought, Georgie. But actually, I turned up and they were fantastic. I'm actually going to put some respect onto Chris Martin's name after being someone that has been a diehard God Coldplay of rubbish. It was an absolutely fantastic gig.
Why did you go then? Free.
When I went along because, you know, I haven't seen a concert or a gig for a while. So I thought, okay, I had a point to this as I was walking in.
Sorry.
A t-shirt for a Coldplay gig. How much do you think the t-shirt was, the tour t-shirt, official tour t-shirt?
Well, I recently paid for a Commonwealth Games one, about £24.
Okay, the official t-shirt for the Coldplay gig was £45.
Get out of town.
Yeah. How much do you think the official programme was? Now, before you go any further on this, I don't know what would be in an official programme of Coldplay at Wembley, but how much do you think the programme was?
Okay, so a Derby programme, Derby County, is about £3. And Fulham, actually. But I was going to see that they're bringing programmes back. Anyway, sorry, I got distracted. But if you're going to a big event, they tend to have the big sort of A4 ones, which you've never read in your life, and they just go onto your bookshelf. I'm going, well, they're normally about £10. So if the T-shirt's 45, I'm going to say, Lee, £15.
See, I think £10 is about the maximum I'd pay for a programme. So when I went to the Euros, for example, I bought a programme and it was a tenner, and a tenner was like a lot. The programme, the official programme at the Coldplay gig was £25.
So, Lee, boys.
Is this inflation at work?
No, that's called
just simple profiteering. It was pretty, I mean, as I'm walking in, I'm thinking they are two massive costs. Already the cost of going to a gig and concert is expensive. And I was like, is this inflation at work? My money journalist hat already, as I'm walking into the gig, is still on, thinking like this is mad. And if you're hardcore, I tell you what as well.
It's exploitation,
though,
that is.
I tell you what as well, though, Georgie, on the train home, there was a lot of people on my train home that had obviously been to the gig. All of them had the T-shirt and the programme. £25 for a programme, to me, is just like, wow. I don't know. There's nothing. I could be the biggest Coldplay fan on earth, and I'm not sure I'd pay that.
Helen, goodness me. Would you ever pay £25 for a programme?
Oh, absolutely not. I go to a lot of gigs and I always, if I've paid a lot for the ticket especially, I'll be like, no, no T-shirt, no programme. Because it's just, you pay so much to go, you pay so much for drinks, it can get really expensive. So actually, I was supposed to be going to a gig in London tonight, and I actually decided to sell my ticket because I mean, first world problems, but I booked a holiday last night.
Nice.
So splurged quite a bit of money, and I was just thinking about the stuff I've got coming up in the next month that I, you know, things I've booked a while ago that I actually don't really need to go to. So I've kind of thought, it's a few things I've got coming up that I've cancelled, just think, no, I can, if I sell that ticket, I get that £50 back, a bit more spending money for my holiday. I think it's just about choosing what, you know, if you're lucky enough to have the money to spend on fun things, maybe. I'm just trying to be a bit more sensible and think, you know, okay, would have fun if I went to this thing tonight, but I'd have more fun if I kept it to spend on my holiday in a month's time. I haven't been anywhere since April 2019. But then, you know, when you look at the cost of things going up, you do think, oh, you know, I can't afford this, but things are getting more expensive. Am I going to regret this a few months down the line? So I think to justify it to myself, I mean, it's a last minute one, so I'm going in a month's time, but I've kind of said to myself, you know, I'm going to be really sensible for the next month to allow myself a holiday.
Fair dues. Lee, have you noticed while we're at it?
I'll be honest with you, Georgie. I've always been a very, very thrifty individual.
So I've heard, Lee.
Are
you any more so at the moment?
I haven't really changed my habits. I don't go to the supermarket all that often, but when I do, you know, I do keep an eye on price. I do like to try and get those bargains. I do a little bit of bulk buying and put some stuff away if it's stuff I use a lot and it's at a cheaper price. And that's all stuff that I'll be honest, it's my upbringing. It's just what I've always done. I'm very good at budgeting. I second, I guess, all of my purchases. So, you know, I might see a t-shirt in a shop for £12 and then I'll say,
exhaustingly,
do I really, really need this? Yeah, well, it isn't because I don't know. It's just, I like to keep a handle on things and I hate unnecessary waste. And I've become more and more like it as I've got older because
what are you going to be like in 15 years or something, or 20 years? Or, oh, God, you're a grumpy old man.
We've all got enough stuff. I'm the type of person that buy a T-shirt and I'll wear it for about 10 years until there's a hole in it and then I'll finally part with it. Or I'll keep hold of it. And I'll wear it to do some painting and that kind of stuff. And one of those kind of people, and there's no shame in that. There's no shame in saying, I like to stick to a budget, get some cash out and have that for the week. And you can spend what you
do. A girl now, Lee, you're laughing, aren't you? Climate and saving money. It's everyone's a winner on that. Look, we're going to talk about what things were like last time inflation was this high. The reason I'm thinking about that is because I was actually using my dad's old shirt as a painting shirt recently. So there you go. Isn't that good? And that shirt looks like it was there from earlier than 1982. But I actually was having a conversation with my dad about, Dad, do you remember what it was like in February 1982? And he's like, no, not really. And then we concluded he wasn't even in the country. Actually, he was in Norway, having had his daughter just been born. Didn't remember that either. But he was speaking a lot about the 70s. And that is one of the things that people think about when they think about high inflation is the 70s. But the last time it was this high, so we're going to talk about 1982 again. By the way, if you want to listen to another episode about 1982, you can listen to my birthday episode in January. But Helen, well, neither of you were born, I don't believe, in that year, even, I was about to say that decade, but actually I think that's not true. I think we're all 1980s, aren't we here?
Just 1989.
All right, show off. fair enough. But so none of us can speak with authority here. But what have you learned in your research about what 1982, and specifically around February, I think, when inflation was 10.4%, what was it like, you know, economically, with the strikes, politically?
You're right. People tend to talk about the 70s as a more difficult time. But 80s, obviously, quite a lot of unrest. You know, you think of the time of sort of strikes and things like that. This was obviously a time when a lot of the big industries were nationalized, so gas, electric, coal, rail. And you know, you just think if that was the case now, perhaps we'd be in a very different situation to kind of where we are now. You know, if the people are calling now for the power companies to be renationalized, you know, to in the hope that that would help people kind of get more of a handle on their bills. And tax, though, was quite a bit higher. So income tax in the 80s, the basic rate was 30%. Obviously, now it's 20%. So, yeah, I think higher cost of people in some respects. But, you know, the government probably had a bit more of a handle on and a few more kind of levers on what people were spending on, things like bills and travel, which they don't do so much anymore.
Lee, is there anything we can learn from looking at recessions of past eras, of times of high inflation, that can inform perhaps what we can expect going forward, what we should do, how we should think about it? Or are they also different with different underlying issues?
The 1980s was a little bit of a tale of two separate parts. The first half was very much off the back of high inflation, high base rate, mortgage rates being very high. There was quite a lot of unrest. We had the Falklands War. There was a lot that went on in the early 80s. And actually, Margaret Thatcher, who was only Prime Minister for a couple of years, wasn't very popular in those first couple of years. You know, there was a lot of unemployment rate was high. It was a lot of question marks about where the future of the country went and where it focused on, with a lot of industries dying and that kind of thing. There was a lot of the tough decisions that were made. And then there was a bit of a boom towards the end of the 80s. More people started to own their homes. There were more jobs created in things like the city. And a lot of people think back at that era and have lots of images in their mind about what was going on. Now, in the late 70s, the base rate was high. I mean, it was incredibly high. And inflation 40 years ago is where we're at now. The thing is, with the inflation rate at the moment, it has shot up so quickly. It really has just, you know, come out of basically nowhere. It feels like it's just gone from sort of 0 to 60 in literally a second. That's how fast inflation has gone up. I always think you can learn lessons from previous recessions. And as you're right, the first couple of years of the 80s in which Margaret Thatcher was prime minister, there was a recession. And it was quite a bleak time. At the moment, we're talking about going into a recession, and it's a completely different picture. I mean, the unemployment rate is nowhere near as high as it was in the early 80s, for example. But also, a lot of people and businesses weren't having to suck up energy bill rises that we're seeing. You know, it's a completely different scenario. So in one hand, you can look back at history lessons and lessons from the past. And we don't know who the new next prime minister is, but, you know, potentially if it's Liz Truss, there's a lot of talk about her being basically Margaret Thatcher Mark II. I mean, is that really realistic what's going to happen? You know, we're in a completely different game, it feels like. Yeah, and there is so much for a new prime minister to be dealing with in the coming months. It's just it's unfavorable. I don't know where to start. I mean, it's incredible. But we're hearing about, and we'll talk about base rate in a minute, but there being more base rate rises, you know, to try and stem this inflation. Actually, one little bit of news in the last couple of weeks is that the US actually had inflation rate fall. They've managed to make but again, they're in a different scenario in terms of energy reliance and what they do and how they create their energy to what we experience here and in the rest of Europe. So, yeah, you can learn from recessions. And I feel like there were and always will be lessons that are learned from recessions and the financial crisis. But this is, every time something like this happens, it's a different thing that triggers it. And it's a different thing that's the root cause. And at the moment, inflation is just being triggered really simply by energy.
We have the unhappy mix of, you know, what's going on in America, which was a tight labor market, and we have the unhappy mix of what's going on in Europe, which is of course energy, and together that's kind of got us where we are at the moment. And so the Bank of England, as you rightly said, raising rates as they have a fair clip since December, when rates were at record lows, 0.1, they're now at 1.75%. Predictions, perhaps they could go to 2.25%, Lee, maybe next month when the MPC meet again. You mentioned Liz Truss. With all the talk that she's proposing to cut tax, there are predictions that rates could hit, Helen, as high as 7%. Is that likely?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very extreme, doesn't it? But that admission actually came from a member of her campaign in an interview, which is nuts. I mean, I feel like that person's possibly dropped a clanger actually sort of admitting that. But it just shows that, you know, it could happen. If you look at the speed that the base rate has gone up so far. So 9 months ago, the base rate was still 0.1%. It's now 1.75%. And seems probable it's likely to go up to 2.25 next month. So, you know, it is rising quickly. I mean, first of all, we don't know the outcome of the leadership election. It seems likely to be Liz Truss. It would seem unthinkable a year ago that the base rate could go to 7%. But now I would say, while unlikely, it's now possible.
What I think we like to explore with this one is, because last week's pod, do listen back if you missed it, great one on savings and how the base rate rises have impacted savings. How does it work with mortgages, Helen? What's been happening in the mortgage market since December, or before, actually, just slightly before?
Yeah, so broadly, rates have been going up across all types of mortgages. The banks tend to sort of price in, when they get a sense that the base rate is going to go up, they price that in a little bit earlier. So it normally starts happening, you know, just a couple of weeks before the base rate is set to go up. So it depends on what type of mortgage you have as to what's going to happen. If you're in a fixed rate mortgage, your rate isn't going to change until that fixed deal period comes to an end. What will happen is when you come to remortgage, the price of new fixed rate mortgages will probably have gone up. So you get to a situation where perhaps, say if someone fixed 2 years ago when rates were quite low, they're now coming up to that deal coming to end, they could get a bit of a shock. You know, their rate could have gone up by, say, 2%, which is, you know, depending on the size of the mortgage you have, can be quite significant. The people who it affects more immediately and more severely are people who are on variable rate mortgages. So if you're on a tracker, that directly tracks increases in the base rate. So as soon as the base rate goes up, your mortgage rate will go up the same amount. And if you're on your lender's standard variable rate, it doesn't go up automatically, but the bank will almost definitely raise it to quite close to the same degree as the base rate has gone up. And those rates are higher anyway. So, and they can, you know, that increase can be implemented at any time the bank chooses. So those people are in more kind of immediate danger if and when the base rate goes up.
Goodness. So Lee, you've got an article, you've been looking at what will happen to mortgage rates. Should the base rate go to 3 to 5? And as we said there, even 7%. Does it not just follow in a linear fashion? If it goes up a little bit, then it'll go up another little bit, you know, or.
It does not, really. Right. It's a real basic.
How high? I mean, is there any limit to what it could be, or?
Well, there's a few things to think about and look at and a way to look at this. So first of all, as Hannah's talking about, there are SVRs, right? So SVRs are linked to base rate. Banks are very, very quick to pass on base rate rises, as we've seen in the last few months. And as we talked about a little bit last week about them not doing the same for savings, which is quite frustrating and annoys a lot of people. And the other thing to think about is fixed rates. So how banks and building sites and lenders price fixed rates. And that's what a lot of people are kind of worrying about, perhaps even more so because they're coming to the end of mortgage terms. So quite often people will do a 2-year fix. A lot of people have moved to 5-year fixes now. But you could be coming off the back of that and thinking, wow, when are these rises going to stop? Now, one thing I should point out here, we're talking about the base rate going up to 2.25%. Potentially next month. That's according to a poll of economists that Reuters does every month, 30 out of 51 believe it will go up to that rate. The rest think it's going to go up 0.25 percentage points. So whatever way you look at it, economists in 50 odd are saying it's definitely going to be at least 2% from next month. Now, how quickly base rate rises between next month and the middle of next year, a lot of that is going to be dependent on what happens with energy, because the reason why they're raising base rate is to try and curb inflation. It's just trying to make borrowing more expensive, to make people spend less, to create less demand in the economy, and thus help bring prices down of goods. One question I have about this and something that I think about quite a lot is the thing is with that, people have no control over the energy market. They have no control over the spiraling costs of their electricity and gas. So in a way, I think, okay, raising rates, how's that going to help? Because that can't do anything for the energy market, but it can help in those other costs that are going up, which we mentioned earlier in the show. So it's a very fine balance of what happens. Now, talking about rates going up to 7%, it seems quite bananas when you think about, we've just had an era of ultra low, historic low base rate. And a lot of us have been on very happily a diet of incredibly cheap lending, including mortgages. And we're about to have a wake up call. A lot of people are going to have a wake up call here as base rate goes up and mortgage rates go up. And actually, in the story that our mortgage reporter, Fran Ivans, did, it was quite an interesting stat in here, and that's basically that UK interest rates have averaged 7.15% between 1971 and 2022 and reached an all-time high of 17% in November 1979. Base rate at 17%. There are people out there, slightly older generation, that will be perfectly attuned to what higher base rate means. Now, put simply, quite a lot of those people probably won't have a mortgage anymore. That's not no one size fits all. We're always on this podcast, it's not a broad brush, but there's now a generation of people that have been on these ultra low deals. I'm one of these people who've had a mortgage at below a percent. I mean, it's just unreal. It just doesn't make any, it made no sense to me. And now we're seeing base rate trickle nudging higher seemingly every month. Now, you start going beyond 3% of base rate, and it, could it land somewhere between 3 and 5%? I think that is the kind of, my sensible head would say, would it then go beyond 5%? Well, you never say never, and I don't know what the future holds. I wouldn't be saying 7% next year, because I would have thought that any kind of rises will be like they've been now, 0.25 percentage points or 0.5% might start slowing down a little bit. But if it did go to 7%, could trigger a massive house price crash. That's according to Ray Bolger. He said that a 7% base rate would equal a 25% house price fall. That's his prediction, because basically it would shock a lot of people. And it would become incredibly expensive to buy a house, especially in a time where house prices have gone up, as we always say in this podcast, between 20 and 25% since the start of the pandemic. And an increase of 5% would make life very difficult for many borrowers when they're fixed rates. And that's what Ray says. Ray's a very respected broker in his industry. And he said many would not pass the affordability test to remortgage, but they would still be able to get a new deal from the lender with a product transfer. It just basically means that your rate would go up. And actually, at the same time, do you remember at the start of this month, the Bank of England actually scrapped affordability test. Do you know what the percentage was to test people if they could afford it? 7%. It was to see if you could afford a mortgage if your rate went up to 7%. And at the time where we're now talking that base rate is probably not going to go 7%, but again, I'm not making any bold predictions on this podcast. We've cut the mortgage affordability test that's saying if rates go up to 7%. And actually, SVR rates are slowly but surely getting towards that 7% rate. I think we're talking somewhere between 5.5% and 6% at the moment, a little bit more nudging higher. We're going to start seeing possibly 7% SVR rates. And that mortgage affordability test, which borrowers would do when they took out a mortgage, has gone at the time, the very time it feels like it might really be needed. But I'm not here to make these decisions. It's not my decision. And it's caused a little bit of bafflement in the industry. But I remember when we did the podcast a little while ago saying it was nothing to seriously worry about. But rates keep going higher, Georgie. And I cannot foresee property prices just continuing to rise like they are now. And that could leave a lot of people with a headache when they come to remortgage.
It could do, Helen. I want to know, there's lots of talk, as inevitably there is when we talk about rates going up, about people that have got mortgages. But, you know, as Lee said, there's about a third of people who have paid off the mortgages, a third of people have mortgages, and a third of renters. And I'm wondering what all this tangled web is going to weave for the rental market. For renters, it's going to be, I imagine, I'm not saying every renter is renting because they want to save a house, for example, for a house, or because they've lost their home. But if some of the predictions might be right, some of the worst predictions that, you know, rates could go very high, you know, people can't afford to buy, they can't afford to keep their homes, more people will be renting. And I don't know if you've been seeing all the comments on Twitter as well about, you know, queues outside for people to rent homes, landlords allowing people to bid because so many people want them. It was a two-bedroom in Brixton I saw the other day for 2,500, and people were allowed to just bid for the highest because so many people. Well, these are insane. So even if you can't hold on to your house, what's the rental market going to look like if you do need to look at renting?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. It is insane. I was in that situation a few months ago, being the person queuing up outside a house that was up for rent. Lots of fun, especially because one of them, the agent turned up and the tenant just refused to let him in. So he had to turn around to the queue and say, go home. That was fun. That's in London, where the rental market is insane anyway.
What's happened? Is it post-pandemic? Everybody just wants to come back. What's happened?
I think it was partly that in the kind of early days of people sort of coming back to the office. Now, I think actually we're hearing that a lot of landlords have decided to sell their properties.
Are they fearing the fact that house prices might fall, or are they just fed up with the tax burdens that have happened? It used to be quite tax efficient, now not so. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both of those things. So Yeah, tax burden, obviously, around the mid-2010s, a lot of new regulations came in that basically made it less sort of tax efficient for landlords to rent out properties. You know, they have to pay more in tax. And there's also potential for more sort of regulations coming in for them on things like making their homes greener. So, you know, there's a lot of expenses coming in down the line for them. And I think this rise in mortgage rates, obviously, that's going to affect landlords who own properties with a mortgage. A lot of landlords do own properties with a mortgage, especially ones with portfolios, because they'll kind of buy one and then, you know, use parts of the equity to buy another one. They're quite often quite highly mortgaged. So rates going up is a big deal for them. And I think if their expenses on the properties they own are going up, then they're going to do one or two things. They're going to sell them or they're going to put the rent up. So it's not looking good for renters, and especially because it kind of doubles down, because if landlords are selling properties, you know, they might not sell them to another landlord, they might sell them to a homeowner. That takes that property out of the market, which means that there's more competition for the rent properties that are left, which drives up rent even further. You know, I've been in situations when I've been looking for I was looking for a flat about 4 or 5 months ago. And you're already seeing this. So landlords would ask you to put in your best offer for what you would like to pay to rent the flat. You know, it's no longer just a case of this is the price, can you afford it? Great, move in. It's landlords are saying, you know, we've got X number of people who want this property. So, you know, put in your sealed bids in the same way that you would see, you know, if you're buying a house, and I'll pick the best one, and whoever pays the most gets the flat, which is...
Well, it's not, though, because they also have to know what your blood type is as well. And, you know, you have to go through a couple of meetings and stuff. I've been there. It's mad.
It's crazy. But in this market, sadly, that's something that they can do, and rentals will do it if they can afford to put in a higher offer, because like they don't have a choice. You know, if every property you look at is doing that, what's your alternative? You have to have somewhere to live. It's really difficult. And I think, yeah, sadly, I would love to offer you some good news, Georgie, but it's not looking good.
I need to let the listeners in onto a bit of an insight as to what happened at the start of this podcast before we started recording. We got a bit gloomy and doomy, as we have done. You know, this is inevitable. These are dark times. But we're really determined to try and make this podcast just a little bit cheerier. But every time we get dragged down these dark holes, I mean, Lee, come on, there's got to be something in here.
All right, Lee, that's it
for part one.
There we go, I'll just give you a little chuckle. I don't know what to give you that's cheery, Georgie. That basically you didn't have to go to a Coldplay gig and you didn't have to spend 70 quid on a t-shirt on a program, and you're 70 quid up, you're winning.
That's it for part one.
I'm joined now by eToro's Sam North to discuss what's been going on the markets this week. Sam, welcome to the podcast. Double-digit inflation. What else has been going on this week?
Yeah, crazy. I mean, it's actually been a relatively quiet week. As you mentioned, their UK inflation was the main focus, along with the Fed minutes. The Fed minutes didn't really show us too much new, but as I'm sure many in the UK will know, just like you said, their inflation at 10.1%. Food and drink prices, I think, were the main reason behind that first double-digit number we've had for over 40 years. I mean, this is going to force the Bank of England to raise rates by at least 50 basis points at their next meeting, but it might be a little too late. We're obviously expecting numbers next year around that 13-14% figure. But other than that, markets took a little bit of a breather. We're off the highs that we had, but we've had such a superb run recently, it's not too much of a shock.
And what's on the radar next week?
So first thing to note is it's the last full week of August, and in truth, it's probably going to drag a little bit until September. Earnings are pretty much fully complete. We don't have any central bank meetings for at least 3 weeks, and I just can't see too many headlines developing over the next 7 days, really. However, it's 2022, and this is the year where you just don't know what's around the corner. We've got some PMI data out of most regions, which will be key to seeing just how the economy is doing in those places. But again, not expecting fireworks. I would say the event that has the most potential to move markets is the Jackson Hole Symposium. Central bankers from around the world will meet in Wyoming, and we can expect comments from Wednesday onwards. That will be my main focus. But if I had a fast forward button, to the first full week of September, I'll be pressing it.
Wow, Sam, I think you've predicted a quiet week in the UK economy, which is just a bold statement. But anyway, excellent stuff. And that's Sam North from eToro.
Thank you, Lee.
Welcome back. Actually, we might have a bit of good news for you. How much money do you reckon you have lying about forgotten somewhere? A couple of quid down the sofa, fiver in your back pocket of a pair of jeans. Don't put it in the wash. Although nowadays you can, because it's all plastic coated. See, every story has a silver lining or whatever. Anyway, how about £2,500? That's how much the average Brit could have sitting about unclaimed in forgotten pensions, bank accounts, savings, and investments. Now, that's according to Gretel, a website that searches for people's lost money. They reckon 20 million of us have around 50 billion in total, lying around, not down the back of the sofa. Tell me about the research, Helen.
So that's not just bank accounts. And, you know, you would assume that the larger amounts are probably going to be in pensions, because I don't know about you, but I definitely wouldn't just forget £2,000 in a savings.
Oops.
I mean, it seems mad that Gretel's saying that one in four pensions are currently missing or unclaimed. And you can kind of see that because, you know, say if you've had a job years ago, perhaps when you were quite young and you weren't putting a lot into your pension, didn't work there for very long, you know, you might kind of assume they're just not very much in about it. You might not be very kind of financially savvy and you might just plumb forget about it. The savings accounts thing, a bit more difficult, but you know, if you've closed an account or, you know, you've transferred an account, left a few odd pounds somewhere, perhaps you could forget about it. But obviously the banks don't make it easy for you to find that money. So that's why you've got services like Gretel. There's other ones available as well. So Gretel is free to use. My Lost Account is another one that's run by UK Finance. There's government pension service as well, if it's a pension that you think you've lost track of. Basically, they all just consist of, you know, you'll put some information into a form online and they'll search, you know, companies, banks, and hopefully try and track down your money.
Lee, does this surprise you? I mean, actually, when Helen talks about pensions, you think, yeah, I can imagine there might be some sort of sizable chunks of pension. I'm not so sure about, there might be obviously the odd bank account. But my instinct is, and I want to be delicate when I say this, is this just not a lot of dead people's accounts? Or is this live people's accounts? Sorry, I don't know how better to say that.
Well, I would presume it's a bit of a mix, but I would have thought that dead people's accounts has probably been largely removed from this research, because actually, £50 billion sounds like a lot of money. You know, said in a Dr. Evil voice, £50 billion. You know, that sounds like a lot. But actually, two and a half grand, again, that sounds a lot. But people do move jobs. They do build up pension pots. And it can get very messy, all of the paperwork. And living with someone, my wife, who has had numerous jobs, especially from leaving university till sort of turning 30, she's just got little drips and drabs of pension pots everywhere. And she gets vast amount of paperwork, all different company providers that she's got it with, and that's why a whole industry sprung up you know, for it, and people merging all their pension pots into one and trying to do something with it. And that's where a large chunk of this cash comes from. Now, one piece of interest in this, I thought, in this story, is the fact that a lot of people, the first port of call for this, to try and get this cash and look at what's around, is to use Experian's unclaimed assets register, right? It's a very helpful tool to basically input some details and pull up any kind of accounts and things that you have floating around. But that is actually closing at the end of the month, which is not very helpful at all. I'm guessing it's probably become quite expensive to run. I don't know for definite. I don't know all the ins and outs and why that's happening. But that will make it a little bit harder without using a company like Gretel or one of the others that have sprung up from this. It's worth checking out, though. It's worth finding out, especially if you are someone that we get reader emails all the time about lost shares, for example. You know, bought shares in something like the let's bring it right back to the 80s again. Someone that's bought shares in British Gas in the original float and doesn't have a clue how that's all been split off and where the share certificates are, or where you even start to try and tracking that down. And that's why it becomes a chore for people. People start to think, oh, I've got to fill in this paperwork, do this, do that. But we're in the internet age now. We're in 2022, and a lot of these things have become more digitalized and take advantage of that. Just in the story on lost money, Georgie, I went to Margate a couple of weeks ago for a holiday, a couple of nights in Kent, and one day we went to Margate, and I went and bought a drink in the shop, and it was £1, and I had a £20 note, so I paid and got the change. For whatever reason, I didn't put the notes back into my wallet, and then they must have just fallen out of my pocket. So somewhere £15 has fallen out of my pocket in Margate. I haven't been able to stop thinking about it. That's how thrifty I am. I'm so
annoyed. That's a joke. I said, I bet you haven't sleepless nights about it. You actually have. I hope whoever picked it up, they've done something good with it. Yeah. Invested it, Lee. That you would have done.
It was all just going to be spent down the arcade. So, you know, that was just...
I hope they had a good time doing that, though, Lee.
I do, but to make up for it, I've been looking out. I just, wherever I walk now, I'm trying to recoup my cash, and I found £1 on the floor the other day, so I'm only £14 down, and then I did actually find £5 genuinely down the back of the sofa. So I feel like I'm reclawing my money back.
£5 down the back, it was yours to begin with, though. Do you know, I had a discussion with a mate the other day who, and you shouldn't do this, and I did say you shouldn't do this, obviously, but it was like a couple of years ago. I went to a cash point and I saw some money there, and so I just took it out. I was like, well, that's stealing. But yeah, I'm the worst. Even if I see it on the floor, I'll have to give it to charity. Nice, I can't do it. It's not nice, Lee. It's guilt complex.
Well, actually, Georgie, it's a really good point, because I did then go and spend that £1 because it was in my pocket at the weekend, and I like to take my daughter into a charity shop from time to time, and she bought a new puzzle with it. So there we go, £1 for a new puzzle.
There you go.
In all seriousness, if you're someone that has had accounts, or you should go and have a look around.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like I'm pretty good with my paperwork, as in I know where accounts are, I know what I hold, what I've got at any given moment, but I know not everyone's in that same kind of organized skill way of doing that.
It's a different life, as you said, Lee. Look, you know, I've lived in about 25 different places since university. I've worked in how many jobs? I'm a freelancer. You know, these things, I don't think I've got any forgotten accounts, but I imagine in about 10, 20 years time, when, you know, life gets carried away and I've got even more jobs and stuff, these things happen. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Lee, you mentioned your daughter. A lot of the conversation at the moment, A-level results, GCSEs, going to university. Do you remember that? You've been thinking about that for your daughter, who one might think is a little bit young to be thinking about that, but Lee, you're shaking your head vigorously because you think not. So what has got you thinking about your three-year-old's university education that she may or may not? You just don't have to go to university, everybody. It's not a given.
Yeah, this is something that I've written this week off the back of the A-levels results. And obviously there's a lot of anxiety and a lot of excitement and that kind of stepping into adult life, whether you've got the grades that you were hoping for or not, and potentially going on to university or potentially not, whatever it is that you're deciding to do. It's come to the forefront of my mind again this week because there's some research, official statistics, I should add, that the average student starting now will graduate with £45,800 of debt. Now, we've done a podcast on this in the past, and, you know, a lot of people encourage students, just because it's such an unfathomable amount of money to think about. And to be honest, if you're going off to university, you don't really want to be having to think about that. And to actually, the advice that is given by a lot of experts is to essentially think of it as a tax from when you start working and earning a salary. When my daughter was born, I can really vividly remember sitting on the sofa, one of those long nights where I had a baby that really did not like being put down to go sleep, not put down like a dog. And I was just to reiterate. And I remember it being like really, really early hours in the morning. And I had a sleep in my arm, and my other arm was working out with a pen and pad how much we could save. And then I had like my phone, and I was using compounding calculators and trying to work out what kind of pot we could build for her 18th birthday that wouldn't be to detriment of our living standards now, aka a amount of money that we could save that we were comfortable with, that no matter what happens now, for example, like a cost of living crisis, we'll never stop those payments. It will just go. We just, again, it's almost like having a tax. It's like having my daughter's higher education taxes are coming out of my account every time payday. £75 goes straight into an investment account, 75 quid from my wife's account. And we've been putting 150 quid in a month. We started it with £1,000. Now, one of the key things to this is that I didn't just sit on my hands. I didn't just crunch all these figures and do all this, and I just didn't do anything about it. I made sure that my New Year's resolution that year, my daughter was born just before Christmas, was to take some of that Christmas money, take some of that newborn money, a bit of my cash from my wife and I, £1,000 to start with in that January, and just to keep building that pot. Now, you're right. I'm not necessarily saying that this is to be used for university. I've got things like high house prices on my mind. You know, could this be a deposit for her potentially in her mid-20s? You know, could keep going with it. It doesn't have to necessarily just stop at 18. And potentially taking some cash out of it when she does grow up for things like driving lessons and that kind of thing. The reason, again, why it triggered me writing about this is that it's just gone over a big milestone. It's gone over 10 grand. So this pot has gone over £10,000 already.
She's only three.
So we should be four in a few months' time. We keep going with it. It's going to be a very, very nice a bit of cash flow. And actually, potentially, to help her with higher education, if that's what she used to do, house deposit and things like driving lessons. So that would be the aim. And you don't have to have huge amounts of money to do this. You know, any kind of sum of cash for when your child or grandchild or whoever it is in your life that can use to put to good use at 18, because you've put away £10 a month, £50 a month, or whatever you can afford, it is massive. But I also know, with the cost of living crisis, and people go, oh, come on, Lee, who can afford to tuck money away? But some people can. Some people do have the money that they can go and do this. I think actually what the big thing is, a lot of people just put it off and just don't do it and just don't open these accounts, think it's going to be a faff. But it doesn't have to be a faff. Investing is so much easier now, with all the wizardry of platforms and whatnot, than ever before. So there's no excuse. And, you know, I sleep easier at night thinking, okay, I've already saved up £10,000 for my daughter. Great. If we stop now. And that,
what happens if you have another couple, Lee?
Yeah, one and done, Georgie. Yeah, I've got that.
All right. No, yeah. I don't want to get personal about it, but
no, listen, you ask me anything, you know I'll give you a straight answer. One and done, one and done. But that's another thing to consider, you know, because if you then do have a second child, there's that guilt of, well, you've got to save the same amount for them. Maybe you have to half what you're saving for your eldest child and then put that other half into this new account. There's all sorts of little nuances and things like that to think about. And if you are someone that's listening to this guy, there's absolutely no way I can stretch to that. I would implore you to ask grandparents and whoever. Yeah. Say, look, do you know what? Let's not do birthday and Christmas presents. Why don't you just send me £10 a month in a little... Like, I'm not saying that this is romantic in any shape, way or form, right? And that this is the magic of birthdays and Christmas stuff. But
no, go to a charity shop with a pound.
No.
Buy a puzzle.
Yeah, someone to send you £10 a month.
Do they?
And then just club it all together. People.
That's the woman with no kids.
I absolutely, and I always have, buying presents for nieces and nephews, they're a complete minefield. I absolutely would rather just give them cash, and I'd actually rather just give them a bit of cash every month that went into an account that I know is going to do them good. And then when they turn 18 and go, Corey, you were so stingy throughout my whole life. You never got me a birthday present. I'd be like, bosh, look at that pot of cash. And if you can all club together a little bit, not only are we getting rid of this kind of like, oh, what do I buy this kid? Or I'm going to go into a shop with 15 quid and buy some plastic that they're going to play with for about 3 weeks and it's going to end up in a bin and landfill somewhere. Or that could go into an investment account that's going to help for their future. Now, I know not everyone thinks like me, and I know that a lot of people will be listening to this going, Lee, shut up. But that's how...
You'll go 10 grand in your face.
No, I wouldn't give it that much. Just get £10,000 out, drop it in Margate by mistake on the floor.
Don't do that.
You know, I think a lot of people... Again, another reason why I think about this, and a long-term listener to this podcast, and also a friend of mine from school, I was actually asking me a few months ago about how to set up... We were a little bit drunk in the pub. And he was asking me how to set up and what to do. You know, he wants to save some money for his daughter's future. Again, not necessarily for university, but just, you know, to potentially help out in those difficult early adult years. And I realised that there might be a lot of people in that same boat. And again, I'm keeping this little pot a bit of a secret for my daughter. Now, I'm just banking on the fact that, you know, by the time she hits teenage years, she's not exactly going to be Googling financial stories I've written in the past or listening
yeah.
to this podcast in 15 years' time and going, hey, Dad, where's my big pot of cash? If she did, I'd be quite impressed, and then I can spend the day talking about compounding interest. And
when are you planning to drop it on her? Like,
well, I won't. I don't think I ever will. I think I think it will be one of those, like, almost like an invisible hand. You know, it's like, nice. Okay, you need driving lessons. Well, I'll half or puff, and I'll be like, okay, look, I'll pay for half of it, but you've got to pay the half other half of it out of your job. Nice. You know, that kind of thing. I'm not just going to
like it. They like it.
You know, it's not going to be like, right, you're 18. Here's your massive stash of cash. You go for it, girl. It's going to be slow and steady. Hopefully keep building up it as she gets into her 20s as well. And to not influence any kind of decisions that she might make in her young adult life, because she's realised that she's got a nice pot of cash sitting there that we've got.
I feel like, Lee, I've learned so much about you in this podcast. I feel like I've looked into the future and seen Lee Boyce as an older dad. Do you not feel that, Helen? I feel like I'm getting a right insight here.
You see me as an older dad and didn't actually give the money over to her, and instead I'm just on an around the world cruise for
in
a
your
year.
Garden. Yeah, that would be hilarious. That's not
I should,
what
I should add that this pot of cash is in conjunction with my own savings and my own investments that I've got elsewhere. You know, it's a segregated pot.
We'll see how well she does in life. If she gets a good job, well, she doesn't need it, does she?
He's on his cruise, and me and Georgie are still queuing around the block for
for a rental. You know it. That's a depressing thought. Right. Well, we did end on a cheery note there, I think, ultimately, apart from me and you, Helen. But never mind. Lee's all right.
I should actually just quickly point out, if anyone's listening to this, say, well, hold on, Lee, you haven't actually told us how you do this. I've got a really bog standard Vanguard Life Strategy 100 stocks and shares ISA that's got a low fee, and I can put monthly sums in that just automatically comes out of my account. But go and do your research and figure out what it is that you want to achieve potentially for your child or grandchild, and how to best go do it. There's loads of advice out there that you can go and read. And if really in doubt, you can always pay for some one-off financial advice to try and figure out,
yeah,
you know, potentially, okay, I want my daughter or my child or grandchild to have 50 grand by the time they're an adult. How do I achieve it? And actually, quite often, just paying a little bit of one-off advice could reap dividends. So just go and do your research is what I'd say.
Well done, Lee. All right, that's it. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions for the team, anything you'd like them to look into, Lee?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can follow us on Twitter @thisismoney. And you can also read a comment in the article in which this podcast lives.
Marvellous. And if you like this podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Market updates and conversations around the financial world don't have to be boring. The Digest and Invest podcast by eToro is a great way to tune into what's happening in a fun and easily digestible format. Discover the Digest and Invest podcast at eToro.com/academy/podcasts.